Welcome, everybody, to the April 13th, 2015 meeting of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. We've got a full agenda today. I will note that we have four tax credit bills. I don't have anybody signed up to testify on them, and we're not quite ready to move our recommendations. Those bills by procedure have to go over to the Joint Tax Credit Committee, so we're going to set those over for today. So we will start out with Senate Bill 935, and we'll open a public hearing on that. James?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 935 provides that insurer does not require certificate of authority to transact wet marine and transportation insurance. There is no revenue impact, and there is no fiscal impact, and there are no amendments.
We have a list. There we go. Okay, so we just have two people signed up on this one, Joseph Gunset and William Hurst. This is a little technical fix bill.
That's correct.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Joe Gunset, and members of the committee, my name is Joe Gunset. I'm the General Counsel of Lloyd's America, based in New York, a position I've held for the past 15 years. Mr. Hurst is the president of Durham & Bates, a local insurance broker and agency in Portland. I'd like to talk a little bit about Lloyd's, if that's all right, and introduce the subject of the bill. I'll be as brief as possible. Lloyd's is an insurance market which, as many of you may know, dates from over 327 years in London. It has got a reputation in the United States as being a very honorable and well-respected insurance market, which has stood behind U.S. businesses for many, many years. We entered the U.S. at the time of the Civil War. Our history in the U.S. includes being the underwriter for many of the claims associated with the San Francisco earthquake. We were the largest insurer on risk for 9/11. We provided coverage for extensive portions of the recovery necessary for Katrina, Rita, and Wilma in 2005. Lloyd's operates in the U.S. in two ways. We're a major reinsurer, the third largest reinsurer in the world, and we are also a surplus lines writer, i.e., a non-admitted company. Although we're regulated in the U.S., we make filings in every state. We have significant trust funds in the United States on deposit on behalf of our insureds. We are called a non-admitted insurer. We provide for many decades in this state, in Oregon, where we last year wrote $65 million worth of coverage. We, along with other non-admitted companies, have provided important insurance protection to businesses that are covered by what's called marine aviation transport. And this includes wineries, the shipping industry, many of the businesses along in the port of Portland, along the Columbia River as well. And Mr. Hurst can chat more in more detail about the specifics of his client's needs. This is a corrective bill. We have provided coverage for clients in Oregon, as I say, over decades. Coverage has been very much appreciated by those clients and necessary for the conduct of their business, such as high excess oil pollution cover, et cetera. It is has been written, again, without challenge or without issue. We only discovered fairly recently through a very attentive staffer at the insurance department that there was a need for clarity in the Oregon statute governing this marine aviation transport business. So we've worked closely with the insurance department on the language of this bill, and the Insurance Department has no objection to the way the language has been presented in the bill. So with that, I'd like to introduce Mr. Hurst to chat a little bit about it from a client perspective, from the perspective of a company that has placed business with Lloyd's and other non-admitted companies over many, many years.
Welcome. Thank you. Again, my name is Bill Hurst. I'm with Durham & Bates Agencies, Inc., a small insurance broker in Portland. We have been in business for 108 years. We started as solely a marine insurance agency, and it still remains quite a large part of our business today. We insure ships trading around the world. We insure tugs and barges trading off the Pacific coast in the Pacific Ocean to Alaska, Hawaii, around the world. We also insure vessels operating on the Columbia River, Snake River, Willamette River, Yaquina River, and Coos River. The marine insurance market is large. It's international in scope. Many of the companies that will write the extent of coverage and the limits of coverage are not admitted. They're not in the admitted insurance market, as Joe just suggested. An example of this are the ships that trade around the world. 95% of all the ships in the world are insured with 13 mutual insurers. They're referred to as protection and indemnity clubs because they're individual entities, but they're all come together to pool their resources. They are not admitted insurance carriers. However, they provide the high limits of coverage that are required to operate in the United States, including the state of Oregon. They provide $1 billion worth of liability insurance, including pollution liability. And an example of this that we've seen less than 200 miles from here is the new Carissa, which grounded off of Coos Bay in 1999. That insurance coverage was placed with one of these 13 mutual insurers. That coverage is not available anywhere else, certainly not in the limits that are available of $1 billion or more, and not at the level of pricing that is available by these 13 mutual insurers pooling their claims and their resources. I think, as Joe has mentioned, this is a correctional bill, but I would respectfully request and urge that you pass it. It will allow the farmers that we have in this state to continue to export their goods. They're challenged right now with the loss of some container lines out of Portland, but we insure cargo trading around the world in the same marketplaces. If we don't have that, they will be challenged as far as exporting is concerned. We also import a lot into this state, whether it's big companies that we have based here, Nike, Columbia Sportswear, or some of the smaller companies that are importing things that they will end up using to end up manufacturing for their products as well. So I appreciate this opportunity to be here today and respectfully request you pass
this bill.
Thank you
very much, gentlemen. Questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all I had to testify. Is there anybody from the insurance division is here? Want to comment? Seeing none? Guess not. Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on Senate Bill 935? Seeing none, we will close public hearing on Senate Bill 935. We'll open the public work session.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
Correct. Chair moves Senate Bill 935 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none. Senate Bill 935 is moved to the Senate bill with a do pass recommendation. And let's see, anybody want to carry? Senator Girard would like to carry. Close on that, and we will open public hearing on Senate Bill 713. James.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 713 prohibits motor vehicle manufacturer, distributor, or importer from requiring dealer to advertise, promote, offer, or sell extended service contracts, extended maintenance plans, or similar products or services that manufacture, distributor, or importer provides, originates, sponsors, or endorses, specifies costs and expenses for which manufacturer, distributor, or importer must compensate dealer if manufacturer, distributor, or importer terminates motor vehicle line or terminates, cancels, fails to renew, or discontinues dealer's franchise, prohibits manufacturer, distributor, or importer from denying claim or charging back claim because dealer fails to comply with specific claim processing procedure if dealer resubmits claim in compliance with procedures within 60 days, or from recovering costs for compensating dealer for warranty parts and service. We do have three amendments. The Dash 1 amendments prohibits the manufacturer from requiring motor vehicle dealer to promote, offer, or sell extended service contracts, extended maintenance plans, or similar products with exceptions. Prohibits the manufacturer from imposing separate charges or surcharges to recover the cost of compensation to dealer for warranty parts or services. Provides for fair and reasonable compensation to the dealer when the manufacturer terminates, cancels, or fails to renew a franchise. Amends 120 days to 365 days for compensating the dealer, factors in lease or contracts for a management computer system that were acquired and will no longer be used by the dealer, and mitigates the dealer when a line make has been terminated for the construction, alteration, or remodeling of the dealer's facility, allows the dealer to resubmit claims based on clerical or administrative claims. There's no revenue impact, there's no fiscal impact with the Dash 1. The Dash 2 adds reasonable to amount remaining due on lease or contract for a management computer system if dealer no longer uses system because manufacturer, distributor, importer discontinued dealer's franchise. Removes provision denying manufacturer to recover costs of compensating dealer for warranty parts or service by reducing the amount dealer or by imposing a separate charge. There is no revenue impact or no fiscal impact with the Dash 2s. And on the Dash 3, which we just received about an hour ago, it only adds reasonable to amount remaining due on lease or contract for a management computer system if dealer no longer uses system because manufacturer, distributor, importer discontinued dealer's franchise.
Okay, and they're all independent?
They're all independent. And on the Dash 3s, we do not have any revenue or fiscal impact statements yet issued.
Okay. All righty, Mr. Cosgrove, Mr. Ryan.
Why'd you bring Mr. Dewey up at the same time?
We got Ms. Crowell, Mr. Reinhart. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. I've also been authorized to say the competing trade association of some other manufacturers, global auto manufacturers, has the same view on that I'm going to express to you on this bill. Your staff has done an excellent job talking about all the details in Senate Bill 713. For those of you who've been around this building for a while, you know that we come with franchise statute bills almost every session. And in my experience as a lobbyist for the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, this is the first time in which we actually have a dispute about an issue that wasn't resolved in prior negotiations between the parties. The Bill 713 is completely agreed between the parties with one exception of two lines. And so rather than talk to you, unless you have questions about all the other provisions that have been agreed to by the parties, I'm just going to concentrate on those two lines. And those two lines, if you're looking at the bill, are on page 5 of the bill, lines 27 and 28. And it has to do with the process by which manufacturers reimburse dealers for warranty repairs. The current law, I'll start there and then tell you what the proposed change is and why we have concerns about the proposed change. The current law is this issue can be addressed in franchise agreements between the parties. And my understanding is that all manufacturers have provisions in their franchise agreements that say what the process is and the way the reimbursement charges are calculated. Some years ago, the statute was amended to allow the dealer's choice to use an alternative method to determine how warranty repairs are reimbursed. And it's a relatively complicated method. It requires that the – and it's set out in ORS 650158, starting in sub 2. Sub 1 is you can do it by contract. Sub 2 is this other alternative method. You can take a variety of invoices, 100 consecutive invoices, and average the cost of both your hourly rate for labor and your markup on parts, Or you can take all the invoices of non-warranty work in the last 90 days and do the same averaging. And then you propose this to the manufacturer, and the manufacturer has 30 days to contest that. And the reasons for a contest would be that the result is something that is dramatically different than the market in the community, that the hourly rate is much higher or much different than the hourly rate that other dealers are proposing for warranty work, or that the markup on parts is also much different. That's where Oregon's law stops right now, a contest. And you would think, well, gee, if their parties have a contest, there ought to be a process by which to resolve that contest. And my understanding is in other states that have similar provisions to this, there is a commissioner who actually exists, and that's where the contests go, and there's an independent third party to sort of resolve who's right or split the baby or however the process would come out in terms of what's fair and reasonable. We don't have that in Oregon. That's the status of current law. So the parties are left to either find some other way to negotiate it out or a lawsuit, which we don't think is a great solution, but that's the current law. The proposal that the dealers are bringing to you that we think makes the current law even worse is to reject what some of our manufacturers have done with some of their dealers who've come with dramatically higher rates. And that is, with just those dealers who've come with dramatically higher rates and just those manufacturers who are having that problem, they push back a surcharge to reduce it back to community level. Now, the dealer doesn't have to accept that, obviously. They can file a lawsuit. We're back to the same old lawsuit as the final result, which none of us think is very good. But at least it allows something to go on forward, and the parties can decide, do we really care about this enough to carry a lawsuit? We believe leaving the status quo without the elimination of the surcharge, and that means you would adopt the Dash 2, which does not have lines 27 and 28 of the bill, the bold language in lines, 28 and 29 of the bill on page 5, is better than the proposal the dealers are bringing forward. I'd like to go back and tell you how we got to this place where there isn't a resolution. We have been discussing these issues for months. Last summer, I think we were put on notice that, not surprisingly, we would have another franchise bill. And with respect to this particular provision, we've been discussing it for a number of weeks. And we put on the table a proposal that was most recently adopted to resolve this in another state. And that state is Pennsylvania. And I'm not an expert on what the Pennsylvania resolution is, but that was an agreement made by the Dealer Association in Pennsylvania and the manufacturers to have a fair and reasonable way to resolve these disputes about warranty charges. Up until literally about 2 weeks ago, that was under consideration by the Auto Dealers Association, and in the last couple of weeks, we finally got notice that, no, we're not going to accept Pennsylvania. We're going to have a dispute about this. So the situation before you is a bill that has many detailed changes, which we have negotiated out and we're willing to support, and the Dash 2 agreement incorporates all of those agreed changes without exception, no changes to the agreement, and eliminates lines 28 and 29 of page 5, which is this new proposal for prohibiting a surcharge in those few cases in which there's been a contest of the results of the formula, but no other way to resolve the contest except for a lawsuit. Happy to answer any questions. I'm not an expert on franchise agreements, or at least I wasn't as much of an expert until this last few months on this kind of a provision. Mr. Ross Good is with me. He is with Fiat Chrysler Group in Sacramento, and he might be able to answer some questions of how this actually works in the real world. So
just to be clear, the basic bill as amended by the Dash 1s, you find those acceptable?
The Dash 1s, Your Honor, sound like you're the judge. I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman. The Dash 1s were the dealer's original proposal, but it didn't have the word reasonable. Mr. Labar talked about it. I think the dealers are going to say it should be the 3s, and we say it's the 2s. Actually, the 3s and the 1s together make the 2s, with the exception of these two lines. I've completely confused you.
You have. So.
The Dash 1s.
So you want the 1s and the 2s?
Just the 2s.
Just the 2s.
And I think they want the 1s and the 3s.
Okay. Just to be clear.
Go ahead, Dave. member Ross.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Ross Good with Fiat Chrysler Association. I want to echo what Paul said, but also say that the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers and our member companies have enjoyed a real good relationship with the dealers in Oregon. And you see that by we were able to work out most of the problems that we had and work them out to everyone's satisfaction with this one exception. It's very few industries that are out there that where the customer gets to tell you what you're going to pay. And we pay for parts on warranty. We send them to the dealer. Dealer marks the price up, and we have to pay the markup on our own price. No one's really arguing that except for when things get out of hand. And we're talking about very few instances here, but when they do get out of hand, these chargebacks are required to keep fair market value and keep the cost down for all consumers in Oregon. So while we appreciate the good relationship we have with the dealers, this is one spot where we do have a disagreement, and I think that if we had a little more time, we presented our proposals back to the dealers several weeks ago and kept expecting to have further conversation, and all of a sudden it's time for the hearing, and we agree on almost everything, but we really would have appreciated the opportunity to discuss this with them further. I think probably with a little more time we could have gotten it done, or we can get it done if we have a little more time, but I think this one was just pushed through at the last minute and not to anyone's advantage, really.
So how much would be a little more time?
Mr. Chair, if I might suggest, as I've discussed this with you and other members of the committee, we are here every session with a bill. So one option is the interim. We've been negotiating this since last summer, so it sometimes takes a while. We have a lot of manufacturers to get on board. They have a lot of dealers to get on board. It could very well be something we could deal with on the other side of this building in this session. I recognize your committee has limited time left that it could consider this bill, and I don't think we could do so here. One of the options is to design a new arbitration or mediation process, but that is relatively complicated, requires a lot of parties to agree, and we have to figure out who is the mediator, who is the arbitrator. We wouldn't want to put in something that had a fiscal impact. I mean, we would have to do some thinking to get one that works. As I think I've mentioned to some of you, in other states there is, well, I just mentioned a moment ago, in other states there is actually a commissioner in charge of this kind of thing, and these disputes then go to a commissioner that's already in existence. We just don't have that here, so we'd have to sort of develop it from ground up. And I don't think we could do that by next Monday.
Dave Reinhardt representing General Motors, and I'd just like to echo what's been said previously, making two points. Urge you to pass the include the -2 amendments, and just as a general rule, to in your capacity of approving these agreements, approve what has been agreed to by the parties and leave what has not been agreed to be worked out.
Questions? Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that this would keep the price down for consumers. Tell me how that would work.
So when warranty repairs are made, the manufacturer agrees with the dealer on what the labor rate will be, or defined according to the format that Paul described earlier. But then there's also the parts. Now, when we say have a defective part and it's serviced under warranty or it's serviced under a recall, we provide the part to the dealer. We also then pay the stocking fee, the storage fee, and then we also pay the markup fee, just like any other customer would. So we end up paying retail rate for our own part. Some dealers, maybe a dealer that's in trouble, and I'm not picking out any particular dealer, but maybe a dealer that's in trouble finds a way to increase prices for the manufacturer, and to the point where we say, we can't sustain that part. Price is not sustainable at the market in your area, or the markup is just too high, and we're going to charge back for that back to a reasonable rate. So by charging back to a reasonable rate keeps is a benefit to the consumer by they're not paying this the the overpriced markup that we would have to charge back in the price of our vehicles eventually to make up for those costs. We don't want to make Oregon a high-cost state. We'd like to keep the prices low and keep that advantage for our consumer.
So your follow-up, please. Thank you. So it isn't an immediate advantage. It's a long-term lower price for vehicles?
That's correct, sir.
Okay. That's a stretch for me, but thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
All right. Now we've got Greg Rimspern, Brad Torkin, and Chris Mercer, and Mike.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Dewey for the record, representing the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. Like Mr. Cosgrove, I'm learning a lot about the franchise laws, and we strive to obviously work with the manufacturers because they need us and we need them. And we always try and reach an accord. Sometimes you don't, and you bring the issues to this body. Mr. Chair, at your pleasure, we would probably not go into any detail as to the agreement unless you'd like to know a little bit more about the agreements.
I think only the part where you disagree.
Okay, that makes sense. And let me say, I just handed out to you 2013 economic impact study that was done for the dealers. And on page 7, there's some very interesting facts about the industry. I'll just say, I'll relate one, in that in 2013, the payroll was $627 million. So it's a significant economic engine for the state of Oregon. Now, as I said, we would like to have reached an accord. We were just running out of time. And we looked at the various statutes, and there are other states that have similar statutes. As I recollect, we took the language from New York, and the manufacturers actually have sued recently in Connecticut, and they were not successful in the Court of Appeals there, the second district, and it was on appeal from the manufacturers. I won't get into what those grounds were. But what we're doing, we think, is legal in the state of Oregon, particularly because there are no manufacturers in the state of Oregon. So what we have is a statute that's been on the book for 15 years. We have a methodology to get to the rate that is charged on warranty work. And unfortunately, in our opinion, the manufacturers are trying to go through the back door to raise or put a surcharge on certain dealers in the state of Oregon. Mr. Remensburg will speak to it more eloquently than I could, and we have some dealers here that can speak to how they're affected by it. Yes, we would like to reach an accord. I don't think for this session a discussion about a commission or commissioner makes any sense. We just don't know have any time to do that, and obviously there would be a fiscal on that, and that would be not good for us. So we support the Dash 1, which keeps the surcharge in and all the other agreements, and then it's a technical amendment on the Dash 3 in terms of what we charge, which is a reasonable amount that we agreed on, and that's the change in the Dash 3.
So say that again now.
So we support the Dash 1 amendment. That is
keeps the existing process in place?
What it does is it takes the entire agreement, and then Section 5, Sub A, is where the disagreement is, and that is, and the dealers will talk about a surcharge that would be prohibited based upon the current law. So what we have is we have four or five agreement points, and we have one we don't agree on, and we keep where we want to go in in the Dash 1, which is our amendment. So 1 and 3, which we support. 2 is the manufacturer's amendment that takes out the language that they don't agree with.
Okay.
So we'll let Greg speak.
Thank you. I appreciate the time to be here. My name is Greg Remitzberger. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. So I'm here representing the 264 franchised new car dealers and truck dealers in the state of Oregon. Thinking that I was gonna, that our group was going to go first before the manufacturers did, I wrote this great soliloquy of which I was going to go through and talk about all this great stuff, but I can fortunately bypass that and save you all the time on that, and we'll talk just specifically about the issues where we have a disagreement. Well, let me start by saying this is not something that we made up ourselves. This was we saw other state associations fighting the same battle across the United States. Our board of directors empowered me to go out and research that as something because, in essence, the manufacturers are circumventing the law that's on the books right now and has been on the books for 15 years. As we mentioned in 2013, there was a moving target on how you came up with the labor rate and the price for the parts. So we ran a adjustment to the franchise bill that allowed us to clearly define how that was. And in at that time, as has been mentioned several times today, that we have worked with the Alliance of Auto Manufacturers and Global, and we've had a great working relationship with them. They agreed to that language at the time, but their way of getting around that was by implementing a surcharge. So, Senator Riley, as you mentioned, you're not sure about how it would save the consumers money. I can tell you quite the opposite, and that's one of the reasons why I had these two gentlemen up here to talk with us today, because there's two different ways that we're seeing the surcharge being implemented. One is on a deduction for warranty reimbursement, and the other one is a straight surcharge being added on to every vehicle that's being delivered, and that's in the case of Nissan. I've got Mr. Brad Tonkin, who's going to talk about that briefly as a Nissan dealer and how that affects him, and Chris Meyer of Herzog Meyer in Beaverton that is going to talk about the warranty side of it. But I also want to address the couple things that as we were hearing Mr. Cosgrove testify and so forth, as I was looking at our dealers that I have with us here, their kind of heads were shaking, saying that's not really the way it's happening. I think the part that distresses us as much as anything is the fact that the surcharge is at the discretion of the manufacturer. They decided that they wanted to start implementing this. There is no recourse for us outside of lawsuit to do that, so that's why we're trying to address it through legislation. The franchise, the relationship between the car dealers and the manufacturers is a vitally important relationship. There is no better way for the manufacturers to distribute their product than through the dealer network. The dealers represent their products in a geographical territory that is a big asset. That's the biggest asset they have. The franchise agreement is listed as an asset on their financial statements because it's so important to them and it has value. We, at our cost, meaning the dealers at their cost, build the buildings, employ the people, do the training, buy the tools, stock the cars and the parts and so forth, in exchange for an exclusive right to represent the product in that geographical territory. So franchise laws were established to define the roles of each party in the relationship. And in essence, the way we look at it a lot of times is to protect the investment that we've made on behalf of the manufacturers. In this particular case, when they started implementing the surcharges, they were, as I mentioned, circumventing the existing law that's been on the books for over 15 years. But if it was started off minuscule, it could grow to something quite substantial. And in today's business market, in the way that consumers buy cars, it's mostly over the internet doing the research first. As recent as 6-7 years ago, the average number of dealer visits prior to purchase was over 5 different dealers that you visited before you bought. This last year in 2014, it was 1.2. The consumer does their homework, knows what they want to pay for it, knows what they want to do, and if you have a disparagement, even as small as $100 from one dealer to another, and you're going to give them a good trade-in on their car and so forth, they will go for that because it's if they're going to walk into the first dealer and they're either going to give them that price that they think it's worth and give them a price on their trade-in that they think it's worth, or they're going to go to the next one. And every time I tell that story, there's somebody that says, well, I just bought a car and I went to three before I bought. That just increases the number of people that went to one. So they're doing their homework in advance of prior to getting there. In the case of Nissan, they made the decision that they were going to pay everybody, as per the law, the retail rate for parts and service, but now they started implementing a surcharge to every vehicle that was delivered in the state of Oregon, meaning that the Oregon dealers are paying a higher price for that car than the Washington dealers, the California dealers, and the Idaho dealers, which are the dealers we compete against mostly. So we feel it's a disadvantage for us, and it's, in essence, wrong, and again, going to a point where our dealers are paying more. In the case of the warranty administration, and I'll let Mr. Meyer address that issue, they started implementing a surcharge based on some prepaid maintenance programs where the manufacturer offers free maintenance for a period of years after you purchase the car. So with that, I'll lob it over to Mr. Chris Meyer and have him address that issue, and then we'll go back to Brett and talk it.
All right. So I wrote it out just so I could stay on track here. So thank you for the opportunity to address the committee today. My name is Chris Meyer. I'm a partner at Herzog Meyer Auto Center in Beaverton. And among other franchises, we've been a Volkswagen dealer since 1979. I'm here today to specifically describe and discuss the impact of surcharges that our dealership's obligated to pay back to Volkswagen under Volkswagen's Carefree Maintenance Program. To provide a brief background, 2008 Volkswagen announced the introduction of a scheduled maintenance program. They branded to the public as Carefree Maintenance. In summary, Carefree Maintenance would provide the original owner of a 2009 or later Volkswagen with no charge scheduled maintenance. Ostensibly, the goal in marketing this to the public was to show a competitive edge through a lower cost of ownership. At the time of the initial announcement, Volkswagen dealers were both cautiously optimistic about a program that provided a competitive advantage for buying a Volkswagen, yet at the same time wary of any factory program that provided something free without knowing the specific details. As it turned out, in order to keep the specific cost of the program down, Volkswagen selected 10,000, 20,000, and 30,000 miles as the specific service intervals they would cover. Right off the bat, many consumers who had been accustomed to, at very minimum, changing the oil and checking the brakes on their vehicles every 3,000 to 5,000 miles, expressed concern about being told they didn't have to do basic maintenance for 10,000 miles at a time, which is perhaps over a year's worth of operation for some owners. As dealers, we were put in the awkward position of having to support these factory-mandated 10,000-mile intervals while tacitly acknowledging that doing at least basic maintenance at 5,000-mile intervals was truly the best way to ensure reliability and integrity of a vehicle over the long haul. However, the manufacturer also strictly limited the specific items and repair times that would be included at each interval, which further reduced the items that would be inspected and maintained at each visit. Finally, and to the point of why we're here today, Volkswagen announced internally to the dealer body that while every service would be reimbursed via the warranty system, which under Oregon statute and similar laws in other states would mean reimbursement at our retail labor rate, each instance would similarly trigger a surcharge of $15 per Carefree Maintenance repair order. That amount was shortly afterwards increased to $21. It's interesting to note that Volkswagen also insisted that the surcharge expense be spread in equal one-third parts between our service, parts, and new car departments, as if to minimize the visibility of such a charge on our financial statements. To put the double impact of a shortened labor time plus the surcharge in perspective, I'd like to briefly compare a VW Carefree Maintenance 30,000-mile service with a similar service that we would offer to a customer paying for the equivalent maintenance at the same intervals. For this example, I'll use a 2013 Volkswagen Jetta. I'll calculate using our retail labor rate of $115, our reduced maintenance rate of $98. A 20,000-mile service is a labor time for a customer pay of 1.5 hours. That would generate $147 in labor. Through Volkswagen's Carefree Maintenance reimbursement, the same maintenance is shown at only 1.2 hours, or $138 of labor at the $115 an hour. That's further diminished by the $21 surcharge for a total of $117 in labor. That's a net difference of $30 between the two services. So they're paying us $30 less through their program. 30,000-mile service, which most manufacturers would consider the first major maintenance, has labor time for customer pay of 1.9 hours. That would generate $187 in labor. Volkswagen's carefree maintenance reimbursement on the same maintenance is only 1 hour, or $115 of labor, further diminished by the $21 surcharge for a total of $94 in labor. That's a net difference of $93 between the two services. What's the result of all this? Well, under carefree maintenance, many items that would normally be recommended maintenance at each interval have simply been removed from the menu. Furthermore, with such a dramatic reduction in labor dollars, techs are forced to rush through the service in order to complete it in the prescribed time intervals. In either case, quality suffers and the customer's car is not receiving the maintenance it needs to ensure longevity and reliability. So in summary, under the carefree maintenance program, Volkswagen not only throttles labor times at each of the scheduled maintenance intervals, which is arguably a prerogative, but also backcharges the dealers for each job done in the form of a surcharge, which hurts consumers in the form of reduced quality and depth of maintenance on their vehicles, but most egregiously, the process of paying at retail per the Oregon law, but surcharging after the fact circumvents the state statute that provides that dealers be reimbursed for warranty operations at the prevailing labor rates. And on behalf of the Oregon dealers, I'd like to thank you for your time and consideration in this matter. And I just wanted to add one thing. I just made a couple notes as the gentleman from the associate from the Alliance was talking. He indicated that these surcharges were only done to some dealers and that there was some indication that it was on a case-by-case basis and it was really being addressed at the dealers who had higher than average warranty labor rates. That's not the case. In the case of Volkswagen, there's over 600 Volkswagen dealers in the country. All 600 plus dealers pay the same surcharge. There's no disparity between one dealer and another. Warranty rates are not arbitrary, and I heard one other thing that was very disturbing. Warranty rates are not arbitrary, nor do they relate to the financial health of a dealer. We as dealers apply for these modest increases, at least for Volkswagen, one time per year. We're allowed one increase per year. It is a little disconcerting to hear testimony that some dealers might raise their warranty rate to offset financial difficulties, and that's why the surcharge is needed. So that's pretty much a real-world scenario of how the surcharges affect us.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, gentlemen. Thank you for your time today. My name is Brad Tonkin from the Ron Tonkin family of dealerships. We employ just over 1,000 people in the state of Oregon. I want to speak about the warranty reimbursement. Frankly, the issue was settled 15 years ago when the law was passed. So when that law was passed, the idea behind it was that the manufacturer would pay for the cost of a repair the very same cost that a consumer would pay when they come into the dealership and were to have the car serviced without warranty at the dealership. Currently, the manufacturer does not pay that. The manufacturer pays less, even though the law was passed. So you might ask why that is. One of the gentlemen from the Alliance said that it's a fairly simple formula in order to get this done. The dealer has to comply by submitting 100 repair orders and go through a process by which the manufacturer would then approve the rate. Frankly, the submission of 100 repair orders is so onerous on the dealer that it took us several tens or hundreds of hours to get this done, and we would continually get letters back from the manufacturer that said, no, this was not done properly. As a matter of fact, it was so difficult that an independent company put together a computer program and sold it to the dealers so that they could get assistance by this vendor to submit the warranties for the increased rate to the manufacturer. A gentleman from the Alliance said, well, the way that we remedy this currently is that we can go to court. Trust me, you don't want to sue the hand that feeds you. You don't want to take the manufacturer to court, the one that supplies you your vehicles. It's very poor business practice on the behalf of the dealer. And the dealer, frankly, doesn't have the resources or the time or energy to take the manufacturer to court. So we found that with the assistance of this vendor, and there are other vendors out there like this, the manufacturers finally said, okay, we're going to pay you the retail rate. But in the case of Nissan North America, which, frankly, I wasn't going to call out the name of the manufacturer, because we are a dealer for Nissan. But nevertheless, Greg already mentioned it. In the case of Nissan North America, they said, well, Oregon dealers, in order to offset our additional cost to pay you the retail labor rate for warranty repairs that we perform for dealers in the state of Oregon, we are going to increase the cost of your car. Now, this to me was unconscionable. I mean, here we work in a business where we have done, the automobile business has done its level best to make sure that there's equity in the products they sell. And what I mean by that is every single dealer in the country pays the same amount of money for a like-kind automobile. It doesn't matter if they're the largest volume dealer in the country that sells 1,000 of them a month, or if they're the smallest dealer in the country that sells maybe 4 or 5 a month. Those dealers pay the same amount of money for that vehicle. Why? Because it gets back to the consumer. A consumer should be able to purchase that product without regard to the size of the dealer for the same amount for like-kind pricing. But in this case, what Nissan North America did is they said, well, we're going to increase the cost of the car to the dealers in Oregon, which if it increases our cost, it certainly increases the cost to the customer. So that's one of the pitfalls of this, is that the consumer is having to pay more for a Nissan in Oregon when they can simply go to Washington or Idaho or Northern California. The second impact of the state is this. If consumers are going to leave the state to buy from Washington or Idaho or California, then so does the money and so does the revenue, which isn't good for the state either. So that's why I would ask for your support for what we've asked for today. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Questions? Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of things. I'm not quite sure. First, the Volkswagen, you said that they charge a surcharge to everybody across the country. So it's not just Oregon.
That's correct.
But Nissan has picked out Oregon for their surcharge. So it varies by manufacturer.
It varies by manufacturer, and our concern is it sets a precedent whereby if one manufacturer can do it, before long, they'll all do it.
Follow up? Also, you talked about consumers going to the neighboring states to buy their cars. Of course, we don't have a sales tax here, so I mean, it's very likely we're getting people coming from everywhere else to buy their cars here. So tell me why that's wrong.
If I could address that, Senator Riley, if we sold a vehicle to a Washington resident, we still are obligated to collect the Washington tax and submit on their behalf. Same with California and Idaho as well, too. So
thank
as
you.
Much as that sounds great, it would be great for our business if we didn't have to do that because we would have
every car
coming in.
But on the other hand, but that wasn't really my question. You talked about Oregonians going somewhere else. And I know that some dealers in some places, you know, don't charge the sales tax to Oregonians. But I know that other places do. So.
Actually, I can answer that.
Yeah.
We do sell a fair number of cars in Washington, Idaho, and so forth. There really is no state that charges sales tax. Cars are unique in the sense that the sales tax, especially in Washington, is collected at the time of titling, not the time of purchase. So if an Oregon consumer goes to Washington and buys a car, they're not charged Washington sales tax. Same thing with Idaho, same thing with Montana or wherever. They're not charged sales tax on the purchase of a car because they bring it back. They're provided an exemption. They bring it back and register in Oregon. Okay. Vice versa, anyone from any state with sales tax that buys a car in Oregon, there was a time where they would try to fly under the radar. That's no longer the case.
Okay.
We provide them the title of the MSO. They take it to their local licensing and pay sales tax at that point.
Fine. I'm sorry. I kind of went astray there a little bit. I'm still curious about why we get charged more in Oregon. Is it because we charge more for the repairs?
It's actually because the manufacturer is having to comply with the legislation that was passed 15 years ago that requires them to pay the retail rate for parts and labor conducted for a warranty repair.
And some states don't have this.
And
very, very few states don't have that same provision. It's something that went into place a number of years ago. Actually, Oregon was one of the first ones to do it, and many other states followed suit. But again, it's at the discretion of the dealer to ask the manufacturer to pay for that in submission of those claims in order to get it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Girard?
Yeah. I've kind of analyzed this a little bit, and the question is, who has the hammer? The way it sits right now, the manufacturers have the hammer. And if we pass this bill, it looks like you would have the hammer. And here's the question I would have to kind of dissipate that. What happens if a dealer is charging way above the average in that region?
With the manufacturer, in order to have your retail, your warranty labor rate increased, they require you to do a market survey. So they're making sure that your retail labor rate is equitable in the market with every other dealer. If a dealer's charging $115 per labor hour, then they could not ask for $200 per warranty hour. And if a dealer wanted to charge an exorbitant rate on the warranty side, then they would charge that on the retail side, and then their service business would completely dry up, and there would be no repairs. So the market, the forces of the market keep that in check, and the manufacturer audits to make sure that the rates are reasonable.
Yeah, in most markets, you'll find the warranty labor rates for the dealers are within spitting distance of each other, within dollars of each other, not tens of dollars, 20s, hundreds of dollars. So the fact that we have to apply to the manufacturer, and they were the ones that approve the increase, and they approve it via the mechanism of us supplying a certain number of repair rates to justify the market value, would preclude a dealer, especially as was brought up, a dealer with financial difficulties, which I find funny, from arbitrarily setting a warranty labor rate far in excess of the rest of the market.
No, good.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all I have signed up to testify. Does anybody else wish to testify? Okay. Seeing none, we will close public hearing. We'll open work session on Senate Bill 713. Committee, your pleasure. Senator Thompson.
I move the dash two.
Move the dash two.
Oh, wow.
All righty. Discussion on the senator's motion.
I just like to comment. I mean, this group has seen, you know, it's my first time that I've seen this group not come to agreement on issues before, and I just think we ought to go with the things they settled on and put them back in a room, and maybe they could fix it on the House side and come together instead of us deciding something we don't know 100% of the issue about.
So the old familiar, we'll fix it on the House side.
Or somewhere. But, you know, they came to agreement on, I don't know how many issues they had, all but this one, and it's a pretty complicated issue, and I don't know if this
further discussion
should decide that.
Senator Girard.
Yeah, it doesn't seem that complicated to me. I'm sorry. It just seems like if I was designing policy, I would have right out of the gate the manufacturer pay what's agreed to, whatever the low ball rate is. And if they think that there should be a surcharge or whatever, that would have to go to binding arbitration. But that's, you know, that's me. I hate giving... What, and the manufacturers, to me, really still have the hammer. Yeah. But if we give it the other way, I think the dealers have the hammer. And I think there's got to be some middle ground somewhere. So yeah. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. This one's kind of a tough policy question.
Other discussion? Senator
yeah,
Riley?
I agree with what Senator Girard just said. But that's not what we're looking at now. We're not looking at a bill for arbitration. I wish we were. For me, I believe that, as he points out, the manufacturers have the hammer, as he calls it. I think they always will have, because they have the cars. And so I'm leaning very much to go with a dash one or a dash three.
Okay, other comments?
Where are you at?
Well, I haven't said yet. Senator Monroe?
I'm a no on the dash two.
No on the dash two.
Yeah.
Well, my sense is on this one is that I'm in agreement with Senator Girard. I think the most logical position is to have some type of arbitration provision, but we're not going to get there. Just weighing the two, it's hard for me to believe that the manufacturers don't have the hammer on this one. It makes sense. So I'm going to be a no on the motion as well. So let's call it.
Senator Monroe.
No.
Senator Thompson.
Yep.
Senator Riley.
No.
Vice Chair Girard.
Yes.
Chair Beyer.
No.
I could go either way.
Yeah.
All right. Senator Riley, do you have a motion?
I would move which either dash one.
Do you need both one and threes? I
and
guess you get them one
three.
At a time. You got to do them one at a time.
Okay, I'll move the dash one.
Senator Riley's moved the dash ones to Senate Bill 713. Discussion on that motion. Let's call it.
Senator Monroe.
Aye.
Senator Thompson.
Doesn't really matter.
Yes, it does. You have to make a choice.
I do.
You do.
Oh, I'll vote no then.
Senator Riley.
Aye.
Vice Chair Girard.
Aye.
Chair Beyer.
Aye. Do you have another?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash three to the bill.
Any discussion on that motion? One more time, Jessica.
Senator Monroe.
Aye.
Senator Thompson.
Already said that. No.
Senator Riley.
Aye.
Vice Chair Girard.
Aye.
Chair Beyer.
Aye. Dash threes are adopted. And did I say the dash ones were? Dash ones and threes are adopted. Senator Riley, want to try the whole bill?
Sure. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill
713
to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Riley.
As amended. Thank you.
Senator Riley has moved Senate Bill 713 as amended by the dash one and dash three amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion?
Not carried.
Jessica?
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
Nope.
Senator Riley?
Aye.
Vice Chair Girard?
Aye.
Chair Beyer?
Aye. Senate Bill 713, as amended by the dash ones and dash threes, are passed to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Riley will carry. We'll close work session on that. And you can try again on the other side. All righty, so we're going to open public hearing on Senate Bill 714.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 714 prevents motor vehicle manufacturer, distributor, or importer from taking certain adverse actions against motor vehicle dealer because dealer sold motor vehicle to customer that exported motor vehicle to another country or resold motor vehicle for export to another country. Specifies exemptions, including the dealer knowing or reasonably knowing that the customer intended to export or resell for export. Details the limit of the dealer knowing or reasonably knowing if the customer intended to export by presuming the dealer was unaware if the dealer sold the motor vehicle to a resident of the United States who registered and titled the motor vehicle in a state or district with the United States. There is a dash one amendment, clarifies the franchise law regarding chargebacks on vehicle sales where the vehicle is later exported when the dealer does not know a vehicle was purchased for export, changes the limit of the dealer knowing or reasonably knowing of extent to export to, quote, a dealer that register or causes a motor vehicle to be registered in this state or another state and that collects or causes to be collected any sales or use tax required in the state establishes a rebuttable presumption that the dealer did not have reason to know that the customer intended to export or resell the motor vehicle, close quote. There is no revenue impact with this dash one amendment and no fiscal impact.
Great. Mike?
Thank you. Again, Mike Dewey for the record, the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. We do have an agreement on this particular bill with the manufacturers.
Most appreciated.
And thank you. I think some of you have heard this. We have a do not fly list. There's also a do not sell list. But there are times when a dealer gets caught in the middle, and this is an opportunity to ensure if a dealer does not know about a potential sale abroad, there would not be any reaction to that from the manufacturer. And I'll let Mr. Remesberger speak to that.
So this bill addresses an issue that has come due to the global demand of certain vehicles that are sold here in the United States. In some cases, these vehicles are worth $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 more than what they're sold for here in the United States. We like our big cars. We like our big exotic cars that are not sold in other countries. So there were companies that were buying these here in the United States and exporting them, which violates the agreement that the dealer has with the manufacturer on area of responsibility. And so where it became an issue for us is the manufacturers wanted to nip this in the bud. So when that situation happened, any monies that were given to the dealer as incentive monies to sell the car in the first place were being taken back from the dealer when they found out it was exported. And with incentive monies being $1,000, $1,500, $2,000, in some cases higher than that, that far exceeds the profit that the dealer made on the sale of the vehicle. So now it's a big money loss for them. So as Mike mentioned, they created a do not sell list similar to the do not fly list, and the dealer's obligation is to check on that list to see if the person who's buying the vehicle is on that do not fly list, so to speak. Well, because of the demand and the cost for those, there are these companies that are trying to export the vehicles will go hire somebody to go buy the vehicle in their own name on their own credit, and there's no way that the dealer could know. They check the do not fly list. They sell the vehicle, unbeknownst to them, that the person who bought it was being paid a fee by somebody to sell the car to him afterwards, and then they turn around and export the vehicle. In those cases, the dealer had done everything that they could do in order to avoid that situation, but unbeknownst to them, it still happened. So this bill, which again is a clone of other bills that are around in the United States, basically protects the dealer if that situation were to happen. It doesn't remove the obligation of the due diligence that they have to do in order to check the background of the person who's buying the vehicle in the first place. Again, we have an agreement with the Alliance of Auto Manufacturers and Global on this one as well, too. So we politely ask that to push the bill to help protect our dealers from some unintended consequences.
Questions? Senator Riley?
Just a real quick one. Does this pertain to used vehicles as well? Or?
I don't believe it does. I think it's for new vehicles that have under 10,000 miles on it. Yeah, it's just new vehicles.
Okay, thank you.
So again, that's the only way that they could charge the, now that I'm saying it out loud, that's the only way that the incentives would kick in for the dealers in the first place. So yes.
Okay, Senator. Thank you.
Any other questions? I don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this? I see nobody signed up. Seeing none, we will close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 714. The chair moves Senate Bill 714 to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? None?
As amended.
As amended.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
Didn't I say that?
Okay.
You did now.
Okay. I did. I thought I said that. All right. So did I just. So. Now you got me confused. Senate bill, with no opposition, Senate bill 714, as amended, is moved to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Senator Riley, you want to carry this on, too?
Might as well.
Keep them in order. So we'll close public hearing on that, and are we ready for 480?
Let's see Senator Edwards here.
Hmm?
Senator, can you give Senator Edwards a call real quick?
So should we move on down to 317?
See what else we have.
Hmm?
We have a couple phone calls to make on 317.
Okay.
So
let's how about
975?
Yep. All right. So open a public hearing on Senate Bill 675. James.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 675. We heard Senate Bill 675 just a little bit ago on April 6th. It eliminates requirement that bidder or proposer for public contract demonstrate responsibility for submitting signed affidavit that attests that bidder or proposer complied with tax laws of the states, becomes operative 91 days after of effective date, declares effective upon passage. We have a -2 amendment. Eliminates signed affidavit requirement for bidder or proposer for public contract to a local contracting agency, but still requires bidder and proposer to attest being up to date on state taxes. It has a minimal fiscal impact and a minimal revenue impact.
Okay, so we have three people signed up. This is largely a technical issue, so I've got Diane Lancaster, Brian Smith, and Chris Feck. Are you all here?
I don't think Chris...
Chris isn't here.
Wrong date. Yeah, that was the one right here.
Oops, I grabbed the wrong one. I'm sorry. I got last hearings. So it's just Diane. Welcome, Diane.
Senator Beyer, members of the committee, I did want to come back. We were just here a week ago, but DAS did ask me if I would come back and very briefly just confirm to you that we have not had a chance to visit with the sponsor fully to get a note for a -3 that would permit state agencies to be excused from the affidavit requirement. We believe this whole burden, which is really the most difficult for the small businesses and contractors who are bidding, was an inadvertent or unintended consequence of House Bill 4122, which was passed last session in 2014. But we are very strong in our belief that it is causing a burden. Just for your information, I polled state agencies subject to our authority. I had 13 agencies respond who all said they were they have varying degrees of difficulty in implementing the bill. Some of the larger agencies are doing okay, but some of the smaller ones are struggling. One thing we found out was that an affidavit, as that bill laid it out, the current law does not allow us to have a repository. It does not allow an agency to just keep one on file. So these have to be submitted every time bidders are coming to the table. And it's affecting 279B, which is all trade goods, all trade services, and professional services. And, of course, lots of small Oregon businesses are caught up in this. So I don't know if you have any further questions for me today, but so we just did want to make sure.
This is just more of a technical fix rather than having to go get the signature on a separate form and just be able to affirm
it for
compliance.
Senator Beyer, I would just add for the committee that the -2 did include a bit of new language that the original sponsor, Representative Holvey, I know who was one of them, asked to include, which would strengthen the language to from around certification to a little higher level of what we'd call attestation. So it would strengthen the language that bidders would have to sign.
Questions?
How long is it going to take to get the -3s?
Senator Girard, I'm to meet with Representative Holvey's office first thing in the morning. I know that our legislative manager, our Deputy Coup, Barry Pack, talked with his office on Friday. So I cannot give you certain, but we're working as quickly as we can to resolve the issues. And if needed, I suppose we could work with this if it moves over to the other side. So we don't want to hold up. And Multnomah County, who did come to the table last week, said they will work with me and the state to make sure that we resolve this issue by the time it gets set up over on the House side, if this committee sees fit to pass it through.
That'll give the House something to do.
Yeah.
I don't know if I trust the House, but, yeah, I think that's probably what we have to do.
Well, Holvey was one of the sponsors of the original bill, and he's in concurrence with this, I believe. All righty, so... Anybody else wish to talk?
Thank you,
anybody
sir.
Else wish to testify on Senate Bill 675? Seeing none, we'll close that. We'll go to work session. The chair moves the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 675. Discussion. Is there any opposition? Dash 2s are adopted. Chair moves Senate Bill 675 as amended by the Dash 2. Is there any discussion on that motion?
I'm going to put it to the floor.
Move to the floor. Yes, to the floor. That's where I intended it to go.
Would they do pass
to the floor, but they do pass recommendations. Thank you. We're just moving things along a little too fast here today, aren't we? Okay. Is there any opposition to that motion?
Plenty of help.
Senate Bill 675, as amended by the Dash 2, is moved to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. The chair will carry.
Very good.
We'll close on 675. Good. By the way, Senator Edwards here? He was just here. Where did he go?
There he is.
Okay. So we will open. I closed on that one, didn't I? We will open a work session, a public hearing on Senate Bill 488. James?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 488 requires Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services to establish uniform standard for hand dryers installed in public restrooms, including standards that impose limit on decibel level of operating hand dryer. We do have a Dash 2 amendment, replaces original measure, defines hand dryer, requires hand dryer in public restroom to operate at a noise level of not more than 84 decibels, requires downward blowing hand dryer to not blow air at an air velocity that exceeds 115 miles per hour. There is no revenue impact, and we are still awaiting a fiscal impact statement to be issued.
Okay. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the rest, for the record,
welcome back.
Chris Edwards, State Senator from Eugene. I'll start off by saying that this is not the usual flavor, I hope, anyway, of most of my most of the bills that I bring forward in the legislature. And I wish that I didn't have to bring a bill like this, but for those of you that have had family members or loved ones or people that you know that are affected by sensory disabilities or developmental disabilities and have particularly heightened sensory issues, you know that this actually can be an issue for your family. So for those folks that have a lot of those hearing, in particular hearing sensory issues, the really sudden, really loud, really obnoxious noise of these newer generation of hand dryers can really be quite upsetting. And I've been the personal witness as my son, in when he was a few years younger, would go to use these types of hand dryers, and it would trigger what could be characterized as an episode. You know, I mean, you know, screaming, yelling, covering of the ears, running out, and really creating a scene. And when a 4 or 5 year old on the autism spectrum experiences something like that, it can take a long time to settle a child down. So, you know, fast forward several years, he doesn't have those issues anymore, and I probably wouldn't have thought to bring this bill this legislative session had these hand dryers not just continued to proliferate, and they're getting more and more popular. And some of the hand dryers are don't really create that really sharp, shrill, high-level decibel sound, and some do. And it's interesting, when I started looking into it, you know, they don't. It's not the operation of the motor that's loud; it's the hitting of, you know, the creation of the air knife, so to speak, against the hand that creates all the really loud noise, which is why we included in the Dash 2s, and we're only considering or only promoting the Dash 2s, that the inclusion of 115 miles per hour airspeed be included, because not all of the hand dryers label decibel level. So some of them do, and some of them don't. Some of them just label a miles per hour in speed that the air travels at. So the Dash 2s
as brought. They only affect new construction and renovations where a hand dryer will be replaced or installed. In those cases, only hand dryers with a decibel level of no more than 84 decibels or air velocity of 115 miles per hour, as identified on the manufacturer's label, will be allowed to be installed in restrooms. The hand dryer specifications would be added to the walkthrough list for inspections done by DCBS. And this Dash 2 was developed in consultation with the Building Codes Division of DCBS and in consultation with the National Electrical Contractors Association, who had concerns with the first of the original form of the bill. It's probably fair to say that while NECA, I don't believe that they are opposed, they're probably, they advised us on how to make a bill that they had concerns with better and something that they could live with. I don't know that they'll be here in testifying in favor of it. I'm not really sure, to be honest. So that's what the bill does. It is designed to slow or halt the proliferation of this particular type of hand dryer for the reasons I've already outlined here. Once the bill is passed and it goes through the whole process, then contractors and suppliers and parts houses, they'll know about it, and so I think that will have the effect that I'm looking for, and that is that as hand dryer manufacturers are looking for new ways to build a better mousetrap, so to speak, that they will consider the hearing needs of those that can really be affected by this type of product. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator, I'm looking at the language, and there's no in where it isn't clear that it only is on new installations.
I just have a copy of the Dash 2s with me, so I would punt to the department who said that they are here to answer some of those type of things, and okay. They could tell you why it's only on new new construction or an installation. So basically, if a permit is pulled for that type of work, so if it's a general electric, my understanding is that if a general electrical permit for other types of work that don't include the hand dryer, but you're just doing electrical work in the bathroom, a restroom, say, would not trigger a necessity for compliance with the measure.
What's the significance of blowing air downward?
There are some like hand dryers that blow air where they blow air sideways, and you place your hands between them and then draw them up, and it blows the air up. Those don't have the noise issue.
It's interesting.
So they're much, much quieter than the ones that are.
Senator Thompson?
So just to kind of put it, like 10, 15 years ago, it was probably a patented thing. You had to push the button. Every one of them was the same. So that's why I'm assuming it was a patented thing. And now the statute of limitations are gone. And it blew some air, but it was kind of wimpy. And you stand there and end up wiping the water off.
So I'm a fan of paper towels myself.
It takes 20 minutes to get out of there.
Yeah.
So the new ones are faster, better. I wish you would have banned them all and gone back to paper, because I can't stand any of those blowing ones. If you put it back in perspective, the 115 mile an hour thing that you're talking about, is that like the old push button ones? You stand there for half an hour?
No.
Dry your hand? So where are we going back to?
No. So I don't know exactly, Senator Thompson, Mr. Chair, what the exact miles per hour at the – but there are some – so on the decibel level, mm-hmm. On the decibel level, there are ratings of all the different types of hand dryers, and the magic cutoff point between ones that are seem to be more less obnoxious and the ones that are more obnoxious is 84, 85 decibels. And then I've been told by, and somebody just brought me some information that it's a similar thing for the miles per hour. So that it was 115 miles per hour was picked because that is the one that's the miles per hour that would accomplish what we're trying to do. There are, I believe, hand dryers that are this new generation that have more velocity. They dry your hands more quickly, but they're not just quite as supercharged, so to speak.
So where are the?
That's the really loud.
Dyson's the only one I know that you stick your hands in.
That's the yeah.
Is that under 84?
Yeah. Yeah.
Those are kind of wimpy too, in my opinion.
Wimpy too. Mr. Paperman. Okay. Question to the Senator.
Like I said, Mr. Chair, I wish, you know, and I almost didn't bring this bill because this is not the most consequential bill of the legislative session. I think we all know that. But nonetheless, for those of us that just find these hand dryers to be extraordinarily obnoxious and disruptive to family members, I
yes, sir.
Felt the
but
need.
This could be the windiest bill of the session.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah,
any
Mr.
other
Chair?
Legitimate questions? Thank you. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
There you go.
Is that what Billy makes you do?
Thank you.
Is there anybody else before I get to Mark? Anybody else who wants to testify on Senate Bill 675? Mark, I do have a question. Actually, the one I asked. Looking at this, how do we know that it's not retroactive? Is that a way to say that? Or
yeah. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long. In our world, most of the things that we do are new going forward, so that's just kind of our general culture. And then the key word that we thought was in the Dash 2 amendments was the word installed, which is a kind of a term of art in the building code system. A new installation or installed talks about as of the date of the bill, which I believe the bill does not have an emergency clause or a specific date, so I assume it's January 1st, right? I think so. As of that date, a hand dryer installed has to meet the new standard. So it doesn't talk about going retroactive or any of those kinds of things. So it's just a straight-out prohibition as of January 1st, 2016.
All right. I guess anybody else have any questions? Yes, Senator.
What's the life of these things?
Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, I frankly don't know. I still see some of those ones you first talked about with the silver push button and white still in use. So I don't know.
Most of the state rest stops have those old silver button ones in them. And no paper.
I know. I carry my own towel.
Oh, he's got all the answers.
Okay. Thank you very much. We do not have the fiscals on this one.
We are missing the fiscal on this
one.
So
we cannot act on it today. So we will. Unless, once again, anybody else wish to comment? Seeing none, we are closed on Senate Bill 488, and we'll now go to Senate Bill 317, public hearing. James.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Committee members, Senate Bill 317, we have heard before back in February. It prohibits insurers from offering policy that provides the insurer a right that is superior to the right of insured to interpret terms of policy or that specifies a standard for interpreting that is inconsistent with state laws, requires insurance policy to include clause asserting conformance to Oregon insurance code, to state that the insurance code is incorporating policy by reference, and declare any policy provisions in conflict or superseded by insurance code, declares emergency effective on passage, becomes operative 91 days after effective date of act. We have a few amendments with this. The latest amendment is the Dash 5 amendment, makes violations of Chapter 743A, the health insurance cover mandate, i.e. mental health parity, into, quote, unfair claim settlements practices, unquote, removes all previous language regarding discretionary clauses. There is no revenue impact, and there's a minimal fiscal impact with the Dash 5 amendment.
Okay.
And this is where we have two phone calls to make.
Well, let's do the two phone calls. We don't... have anybody here, right? And I hopefully have insurance people here.
We're calling in Paul Turtle.
Paul Turtle?
Yes.
Hi, this is Paul.
Paul, this is Senator Beyer. We're calling into the Senate Business and Transportation Committee, and we have open for public hearing Senate Bill 317, and I think you were talking about the Dash 5 amendments, or maybe not.
That is correct. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Paul Turtle, and I'm a resident of Portland, Oregon. And I would like to ask you to support Senate Bill 317 with the Dash 5 amendment. As James just described, the original bill included some more specific language regarding discretionary clauses. Since that time, the insurance commissioner has completed development of her administrative rules on discretionary clauses, and after several conversations with her, we've concluded that the rules that she has developed have satisfied the original intent, and so we're very happy with those rules. During the initial hearing in early February, we introduced a Dash 2 amendment, and what we would like to do with the Dash 5 is basically keep the content of that Dash 2 and remove the original language regarding the discretionary clauses and so forth. And so with the Dash 5 engrossed, basically what we would have is a very simple bill that makes clear that existing health insurance mandates from Chapter 7438, things like mental health parity and so forth, would be, that any violations of those would be unfair claim settlement practices under 746230 and would give the insurance commissioner very specific enforcement authority of those. It would not impose any new obligations on any insurance provider. So I believe Keith Domenovich is the other person you were going to call in, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. If you'd like to call Keith, then he can also talk to specifically that language and address any questions about that.
Well, Paul, I guess my question is, are you just clarifying, or is it the assumption that those things are already covered under the Insurance Act?
So, Keith, I would encourage you to ask Keith that question as well once you call him in. I think the key issue is 7438 describes provisions that are required in insurance contracts, but there's no enforcement clause. And I think enforcement is likely implied, but it really isn't very specific. And so what we're looking for, since that's the unfair claim settlement practices, is the insurance commissioner's primary tool for enforcing these issues, that we just get a very clear statement within there that, failing to, say, comply with mental health parity is unfair claim settlement practice. So the existing language of the statute would cover things like not providing accurate information to consumers, or not paying when a claim is reasonably clear that the claim is owed. We just, because there have been some issues in the past regarding enforcement of sections of that, we just want to be abundantly clear that honoring the requirements of, say, mental health parity as an example is a very clear and specific enforcement. And again, Keith Ivanovich can go into more detail on that with any questions.
Okay. Questions of Paul?
Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Let's call Keith.
Yep.
Dialing for dollars?
Hi, Keith. This is Senator Beyer with the Senate Business and Transportation Committee. I understand you wanted to provide some testimony on Senate Bill 317, which we have opened to public hearing.
Yes, that is correct.
Good afternoon, Senator. Thank you. I'm ready to go whenever you are.
You're on.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Keith Dubanovich. I am a resident of Portland. I am out in Senator Thompson's district right now, and thus I can't attend with you. I'm here to speak with respect to the Dash 5 amendment. This bill came before you previously, and my testimony is going to be quite similar to what I gave you then, and that is brief and to the point. The purpose of the amendment before you is to focus on one small aspect of the insurance code, that is the required reimbursements under Chapter 743A. The issue that came to my attention was the enforceability of the existing reimbursement requirements. A couple of clients had come to me and said, we're not getting the reimbursements required, what can we do? And when I looked at the series of reimbursements, and there are a couple of dozen ranging from servicers required provided by a dentist to psychologists and social workers, when I read each of those, there was no provision that defined who or what entity of state government had the responsibility to ensure compliance. So the Dash 5 amendment is simply, in my view, a housekeeping requirement and makes it clear that the required reimbursements are enforced by DCPS pursuant to the Unfair Claims Settlement Practices Act. In other words, if a company fails to comply with the required reimbursements, the insurance commissioner takes action under that act. That's all the bill does. It does not impose any new required reimbursements or any coverage obligations on any insurance company. It just clarifies how these existing mandates are to be enforced. So that's my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Keith, the Unfair Claims Settlement Act was enacted, I think, two sessions ago. Not quite sure of that, but I think it's recent anyway. Why do you think these claims are not covered under that?
Well, it's not clear, and when you look at all of the reimbursement provisions, there are some pretty clear mandates. For example, emergency services are supposed to be covered. But there's nothing in Chapter 743A that says how a violation is to be enforced. And so all we're doing is simply cross-referencing, saying here are the required reimbursements. They're to be enforced pursuant to the Unfair Claims Settlement Practices Act. It may have been, you know, an oversight when the Unfair Claims Settlement Practices Act was created. It's unclear to me. In my conversations with a couple of different carriers as well as my own research, I just have concluded that there's no clear connection between the required reimbursements and the Unfair Claims Settlement Practices Act. So to clarify it, that's what this provision does.
Okay, a little belts and suspenders.
I think that's a very accurate point.
Okay. Any questions of Keith? All righty. I guess thank you, Keith. We appreciate that.
Thank you, committee. Have a good day.
Bye now. Lisa. Oh, and Elise. Welcome, ladies.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Elise Brown for AHIP. AHIP is the National Trade Association, America's Health Insurance Plans, and I'm back again. If you recall, I testified earlier in February on behalf of AHIP members in opposition. As mentioned earlier by earlier witnesses, AHIP and its members, its Oregon domestic members, participated in the lengthy rulemaking process under the leadership of the Oregon Insurance Division. Since the first hearing, the rule has been enacted, and we support the rule. So we again here before you today in opposition to the Dash 5s. I appreciate that there's been some discussion about amendments and maybe portrayed to you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that the Dash 5 represents consensus amendments. Nobody has reached out to myself or any AHIP members regarding the discussion around the Dash 5s. So I'm here in opposition. Dash 5s add a new component and a emergency clause, which we're extremely uncomfortable with. And I have my AHIP member from HealthNet here, and then we'll be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
So let me just throw a question. Do you want to comment first? Or?
No, go ahead.
The question is, do you believe that these claims are covered under the Unfair Claims Settlement Act?
Mr. Chair, Lisa Trussell, HealthNet Health Plan of Oregon. I think that this specific wording is not in here, but I think the intent about reimbursement of claims or non-payment or there was a host of items that are identified in that section. But the other thing is that, in my opinion, the Dash 5 and 317, the bill as originally printed, aren't necessary. If the issue is that the insurance code a few years ago got transferred to where all the mandates were put into 743A instead of 743. It was just to keep them all in one spot. But I have no doubt that the insurance division can take enforcement action on any carrier in Oregon if they find that we're consistently violating the insurance code. Arguments do exist, even when you have the mandates, as we do, on what specific procedures or processes are actually covered within that. Obviously, a lot of discussions arose around the mental health parity mandate as to how it would apply to a process called applied behavioral science for children on the autism spectrum. And originally, those services were not part of a mental health service. They were part of a school readiness under the IDEAL Act. And then when the feds stopped funding those, it became an issue, and so that's how it's now evolved. There's been a court case in Oregon. I'm not sure if it'll be challenged or not, but the insurance division has ordered the carriers that start paying for that applied behavioral analysis. Other mandates are also included within that 743A. In Oregon, and some states, you simply send a statement to the carrier to the insurance division that says our policies comply with all state and federal laws. In Oregon, we send our policies over to the insurance division and we can't sell it until they come back and say you're approved. And we sometimes have disagreements about wording and verbiage, but bottom line is we can't go to market if they don't prove the language. And so we're also required by federal law that we have to comply with federal laws, whether the state law has it or not. So in my opinion, the law's not necessary because we're already required. They can pull our insurance license. They can fine us. They can make our life miserable.
Well, I mean, Mr. Jovanovich's comments were directed at he thought that health care was not items, at least some, were not covered under the Unfair Claims Settlement Act. And that's a fairly new act. My memory of that, and I will admit that I may be wrong, but my memory was the primary driver on that was around health care issues and to ensure that the insurance commissioner had the authority to enforce the policies as they were approved. So I would have assumed that they had that authority already.
Well, it is covered in part, I think, but I don't know that there's been a cause of action on under that section.
So, okay. So, Mr. Chair, Senator Riley.
Was that answer no, but it doesn't matter?
Commissioner.
Is that...
Well, no, it's not that it doesn't matter. What I'm saying is that I believe the insurance division currently has enforcement authority over the carriers in Oregon, and they can pull our license if they think that we're not handling claims or providing the benefits that we're selling for the money that we're collecting.
Yeah, so that's a long answer for no, we're not under that, but it doesn't matter.
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, to be clear, health insurance is not part of the Unfair Trade Practices Act, period.
Right.
There's lots of discussion to change that this session. However, you've heard many times that the Oregon Insurance Division has one of the most robust rate review processes in the country, and it's held to a very high standard across the country, and I think you'd hear from the insurance division that they have every tool available in their toolbox to enforce current law.
More questions? Thank you both. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this? Is there anybody from the commissioner's insurance division here? Committee, I think I'd like to hear from the commissioner on this before we act on it. Does that make sense to get a clarification?
I'm a no.
Well, I've got one no anyway, but I would like to know whether they have the authority to act or not. So we will close the public hearing and carry this one over, and let's invite the commissioner. I'd like to hear what she has to say. And I think we have one left, don't we? Or did we finish it?
No, we do have one left.
922. Let's see, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 922.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 922, we heard this last week as well. It provides that reimbursement to a member of a legal expense organization for charges that members incur for legal services does not include nominal fee for operating expenses that legal expense organization incurs or pays to provide attorney. It specifies allowable operating expenses, including expenses that the legal expense organization incurs in referring members to the providing attorney, expenses the providing attorney incurs in processing contract information for members, but does not include an amount that the providing attorney charges for legal services. The last time we heard the -1 amendment, and we have a -3 amendment that we are still waiting for on the paperwork, and I believe Sean Miller is here to discuss the -3 amendment.
Mr. Miller, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I'm here on behalf of LegalZoom, which is a legal access provider. And just last week, I know we had the first hearing, I think during a break during the K-12 budget. So I know I went and I revisited with folks that could not be here. But the -1 amendment that we talked off last week, there's really no changes in the -3 other than some technical changes on the administration fee and what is included in this nominal fee. And just a basic understanding of this particular product, just as a reminder, is they're a legal access provider, which they provide access to, LegalZoom provides access to Oregon licensed attorneys that are doing very simple things like simple forms, a lot of business consultation for small businesses, individuals, like for simple wills. A lot of the small business work is done through like formations of LLCs and consultation, general consultation work. The crux of the issue is there's just a very few, a handful of states insurance code that would actually put them as an insurance company under what is called a legal expense plan or a legal expense organization, which does involve risk. Their business model doesn't involve risk. They've worked with the insurance division. Essentially, the difference between companies like this and what the original statute was intended for is they simply pay an administrative fee or administrative, which is defined in the -3 amendments, to those attorneys, such as opening files and working with their customers. And again, the legal obligation or the legal you know, work is between the attorney and their client. So I know Senator Riley had some good questions, and we I know Ken went to answer that to distinguish between the difference between, you know, insurance company work and what they do. And again, the difference is they're paying an administrative fee, and so there's really no risk to them. Therefore, that's what defines or at least gets them out of, at least clears up the gray area, because you can argue both ways, is how they determined it with the insurance division. Again, the Dash 3 amendment would clear that up. Happy to answer any questions.
I'm satisfied with his explanation to me. So,
okay. Anybody else? So we don't have the paperwork today, so we'll carry this over till Wednesday, and we'll just put it up quick at the top and get done with it.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair.
All righty. Anything else for the good of the order? Seeing none. Closed. Adjourned.
Out of here. Out of here.
Adjourned.